Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, everyone. It's Catalina Martone, Healthy Gut Girl, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. And I'm coming to you, yes, I'm coming to you live from deep inside your small intestines. And guess what? It's looking good in here because everybody is taking their prebiotics. Yes, August is National Prebiotic Month, I decided, and I'm learning a whole lot about the importance of these amazing foods that have been in our diet all of our lives until very recently, has it declined dramatically, which could be leading to a lot of the gut issues that people are suffering from. So if you check out my blog on healthygutgirl.com right now, I have a blog out that is talking all about will my probiotics work without prebiotics? And it is called, what is a prebiotic anyway? Check it out. There's a lot of good information there. And today I'm having an amazing guest on named Dr. Swan. He's the co-founder of Isothrive, and he's here to share all the information about this particular type of fermented fiber that we do not have in our diets anymore unless we're eating a lot of probiotic foods, which most of us are not, and how important it is and what exactly it does for us. He's incredible. Dr. Swan is a subject matter expert in the fields of prebiotics, probiotics, and the microbiome. He is a board-certified family physician, and he is fantastic. I really like this guy a lot. He knows so much, and he's one of the good guys, you know, a medical doctor making his way into this holistic world and doing a fantastic job at it. I do have to give a little warning. Unfortunately, I don't know what was going on with my Wi-Fi, and I wasn't in studio, so we do have some problems with connection, and there is some breakup throughout the segment, and I want to apologize for that. It's such a bummer, but it still is intact, and you get the gist. You get a lot of great information, and please enjoy. Okay, Dr. Swan, thank you so much. I'm so happy to have you. This is very, very exciting. I want you to tell everybody about you first, and then let's go into all the really good stuff.
Sounds great. Okay. And thank you for speaking with me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure. All mine.
So my background first, I'm a physician, clinician. That is, I see patients. My training is as a family medicine doctor originally, and I'm board certified in that specialty. But the majority of my career has been in the health and wellness space, both treating patients, helping them to be healthier, both with lifestyle and dietary approaches, as well as medications when appropriate. And then I also do some consulting for Fortune 500 companies on the health and wellness of their employees. Okay. From a microbiome standpoint, several years ago, actually probably almost a decade now, I started to become very interested in the literature that was slowly developing on both the importance of the microbiome and a healthy microbiome, and at the same time, prebiotic soluble fiber, that is, those food molecules that we don't have the enzymes to digest, but specifically feed the bacteria in our colon that are our healthful partners. That literature has been building for about 20 years, and about probably 6 years ago now, with the business partner, we decided to start a company to commercialize technology out of Louisiana State University to use fermentation to produce prebiotic soluble fiber. The idea being that fermented being the food supply in great quantity, that is, our ancestors pre-refrigeration used to eat a lot of fermented foods, but it's pretty much gone by the wayside. And we suspected and have now started to prove that a certain subset of bacteria inside the human microbiome in your colon really like fermented soluble fiber and don't do well with other types of fiber. And since they have health regulatory properties, you can have detrimental health consequences by the absence of soluble fiber in general and fermented soluble fiber in particular.
So at what point, I guess, did in the history of man, I don't know if this is something we know, but at what point did we actually realize that these foods were contributing to the health of our microbiome or to creating a more diverse microbiome that was then helping our health. I mean, that seems like a hard thing for someone that, for a society of people that don't really know, you know, like, how did they know that? Is that a weird question?
No, it's not a weird question. Let me answer it on two levels. Okay. Let me answer the knowing part first. And I'd say most of the knowing is relatively recent. So I don't think our ancestors 10,000 years ago knew that eating certain plants was, as long as it wasn't a poisonous plant that killed you, they probably thought everything was pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. Same thing with fermented foods. Fermentation is a natural process. The first fermented food ever eaten was probably just something that was left in the corner. And when the owner came back to eat it, it tasted funny, but it didn't make them sick. And they found out that they could always eat that and it didn't make them sick. Therefore, it was a particularly good food source. Mm. So probably the earliest that man started to get an idea that fermented foods were good is, you know, back several thousand years ago. Those fermented foods, as you probably know, have a reputation for having some mysterious health consequences. That is, everybody knows that if you're drinking kefir, or you're drinking kombucha, or you're eating kimchi or sauerkraut, the people who have a lot of that in their diet seem to do well, maybe more so than others. So, but again, that's recent information. How did we evolve with these types of food substances? So if you go back to the beginning of mankind, we birthed babies, and those babies were breastfed. And that's important because breast milk is loaded with prebiotic soluble fiber. Nutritional content of breast milk is literally not digestible by the baby. Baby does not have the enzymes necessary to break down those molecules. And the experts believe, and I agree, that the only reason they could be in there is because they help to nourish a microbiome, to grow the microbiome from the relatively sterile state at birth through 2 years of age of weaning so that the microbiome develops appropriately. Mm-hmm. So breast milk was the first historically and is still the first in breastfed babies today in terms of soluble fiber that we're exposed to. Then if you go back historically, plant-based fibers played a much bigger role in the diet than they do today. People ate a lot more plants and especially a lot more fibrous plants, things called tubers, things that the modern varieties would be things like Jerusalem artichoke or leeks or onions, garlic, that is primarily root types of vegetables. They're quite high in soluble fiber content, either a particular molecule called inulin or its derivative fructooligosaccharides. Mm-hmm. So
can you explain to exactly the difference? You were probably going to get there, but between the soluble fiber, the insoluble fiber, that's the difference for the audience.
Absolutely. Soluble and insoluble is really describing how they react with water. So if you take insoluble fiber and you put it in a glass of water and you stir it around and you look at it, you have a slurry. And if you leave it sit for a while, it'll all settle out. Soluble fiber is more like sugars. Mm-hmm. Put it in water, you stir it around. You look at the water, it doesn't look like there's anything in there. It's completely dissolved. And if you let it sit for a while, it's not going to settle out. Mm-hmm. A related term is resistant starch. And resistant starch is a subset of soluble fiber. So resistant starch, the word resistant is talking about the inability of human enzymes to break it down. So it's starch that resists digestion. And by definition, all prebiotic soluble fiber is resistant to digestion. That's part of the definition, the scientific definition, is fiber that we can't break down that makes it into the colon intact and is then broken down by healthful bacteria who have positive health effect on us by breaking down that fiber for energy.
Okay.
So back to the plants. Historically, or from an evolutionary standpoint, we and our microbiomes have evolved to expect those plant fibers in the diet. And change one in the diet for a modern diet is less plant fibers. We're eating a lot more other stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're eating a lot of processed food where the fiber has been removed in fermented foods. And again, historically, that probably started at least 10 to 20,000 years ago when we became much more sedentary, left the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, and entered the sedentary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And had a need to preserve the food that we were planting because we're not going to move to a new place and get new food. That's where fermentation comes online. So for about 10 to 20,000 years, fermented food and plant fibers coexisted together in the diet until about 150 years ago. And 150 years ago, what happened? Well, Pasteur taught us that bacteria can make us sick and taught us pasteurization, a way of processing foods and drinks, so they're not bacteria anymore. That gave bacteria something of a bad reputation, and we began systematically removing any kind of bacterial contamination, quote-unquote, from the food supply, including, if you will, a crashing of consumption of fermented foods. And then we get to the modern age. We have refrigeration. All of a sudden, we don't need fermented foods to preserve food because we can preserve it through refrigeration. The small residual amount of consumption of fermented foods really decreases quite precipitously at that point. And then we start having things like antibiotics where we're hurting the microbiome's composition through the things that we're doing to try and keep us healthy, but they have side effects that we didn't really realize.
Now, what about, you know, I've done a lot of research, and we talk about this on my podcast, which is that the quality of food that's grown now, even organic food, because they don't rotate out the crops and because they're refortifying the soil with, you know, these NPK types of fertilizers and artificial fertilizers and things, that the foods themselves just aren't as high, as densely nutritious as they used to be. Does that also affect the fiber content of the plant?
Undoubtedly it does. That is, breeding of plants is largely about commercial ability. That is, does it make it more commercially viable? We have not, until just recently, we really, as a society, haven't been trying to increase the quality of the food and especially the nutritional quality. That's a new concept. So, yes, there have been a variety of changes in the food supply that changed the nutritional content and or molecular composition of the foods. A good example of that, to take it into the fermented food realm, is fermented foods are made today the same way they were made traditionally. That is, there's only one way to do fermentation. Bacteria and yeast together, taking the sugars out of the food and turning them into something useful. Historically, sourdough bread used to be fermented. That is, it was a fermented product. It's a fermented process. However, the wheat that used to be used was an heirloom variety of wheat that's relatively high in sucrose. Sucrose is one of the nutrient substances that's used by bacteria. That is, the compound that we make is naturally found in sourdough bread historically, but not very much today because the wheat has changed. It's more commercially viable wheat, but it's very low in sucrose, and therefore the bacteria don't have the substances that they need. So even if you're buying truly fermented sourdough bread, little in the way of fermented soluble fiber.
Wow. So yeah, there's a few places around town that are starting to kind of do this artisanal, you know, baking and things, and they're doing these 12-hour ferments and such. And it sounds amazing, but one thing I was thinking is, because I was trying to justify eating pizza every Friday, and I thought, hey, if I can get a fermented sourdough crust that's a 12-hour ferment, that's fantastic. But then I asked them about their wheat. Is it anything special? And they said, well, we do use organic, you know, wheat berries, and they do everything themselves. I thought, well, I'm sure it's better, but I don't know, like you're saying, like I wonder what the sucrose level is or the content, the quality of that wheat berry. So interesting.
Yeah, in fact, to take off on that just a little bit, the way I couch this with my patients, when I'm in the exam room with somebody and we're talking about health, healthy lifestyle, diet, my guidance to them is, number one, increase the number of plants you have in your diet, unless you're vegetarian already. And specifically try and increase tubers, things that grow primarily underground because they have a higher content. And then I educate them about other foods like bananas or figs that also have prebiotic soluble fiber in them. So that's number one. Number two, fermented foods into their diet, if at all possible, with, if you will, more being better. And if they can't do or won't do one of those, then supplement, either a plant-based supplement, something like a fructooligosaccharide or an inulin, or fermented soluble fiber supplement like Isothrive.
Or both, right? I mean, it wouldn't be a bad idea to do both.
But especially if your diet is deficient in those areas. That is, the typical American diet is all over the map. Sometimes you eat well, and then you got to go on a business trip, or you got to take the kids to soccer practice, and you're catching a McDonald's hamburger.
All right.
So there are reasons why many people might actually benefit from both types of supplements. However, if people are going to alter their diet successfully, they usually are able to increase the plants and the tubers in their diet. A lot of them just won't eat fermented foods. They don't like that acidic kind of taste. Uh-huh. And so that's the one that's hardest to get people to adopt the behavior change of eating the fermented foods.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to originally. I mean, prior to just the discovery of the fermented prebiotic, they were just getting their prebiotic fiber from the plants they were eating, but there was a lack of this fermented prebiotic food. So does that just mean that their, you know, biological makeup was, their microbiome was very different from ours? Like if we took a person from that time and this time and compared their microbiomes, I'm sure there would be vast differences, but one of them might be lack of, well, maybe not now. Let's talk about 150 years ago people, and then thousands of years ago people before they were even fermenting food. Those two microbiomes, they didn't have the that fermented prebiotic in their microbiome, right? Or were
correct.
They getting it in some way? Okay.
Yeah, correct. In fact, let me characterize that a little bit and refer to some of the research that's been done.
Okay.
So it's pretty clear that if you eat a Western diet, you'll have a certain microbiome composition. It fits in a certain pattern. And if you're from a hunter-gatherer society like the Hadza in Africa, they have a pretty close to hunter-gatherer type of diet that our ancient ancestors would have eaten. They have a totally different microbiome. There's almost no overlap. And then if you will, cultures in the middle, that is maybe African culture, they're not hunter-gatherers, they're, if you will, modern, but their diet is significantly different from the processed food diet of the Western society. They're kind of somewhere in between. But these are all distinct patterns that are all derived based on the foods that are coming in. Because as I think I mentioned earlier, different bacteria eat different things. Some are omnivores. A typical example of that might be bifidobacteria or lactobacillus, the two most common strains that you see in probiotic foods or probiotic supplements. And they can eat both types of soluble fiber. They like plant fiber. They like fermented soluble fiber. But there are others that are more specialized. They're finicky about eating one or the other. And that's why having all of them in the diet together gives you something that's more like a hunter-gatherer.
Do we know specifically what those, the bacteria that like those fermented fibers, do we know what their jobs are, or are they all varied? Is it really a difficult thing to figure out?
That's an evolving That question is very insightful, and it's evolving because this is an area of rapidly moving science. The makeup of microbiome in different people, different cultures, different diets, and what the bacterial change involves. I'll give you an example. We know that in heartburn patients, the lower esophageal sphincter, the closure between the stomach and the esophagus, is populated by gram-negative organisms. And in people who don't have heartburn, it's populated by gram-positive organisms. So there's been a shift in the microbiome of population right around the lower esophageal sphincter in the development of this disease. And it's important because gram-negative bacteria on their cell surface have lipopolysaccharide, a particular structure, and lipopolysaccharide has been shown to be able to decrease the lower esophageal pressure, so open up that sphincter, and at the same time decrease gastric emptying. So when the stomach churns, it's not pushing stuff downstream. It's easily pushing stuff upstream because the trap door is open. And what is reflux but reflux of gastric contents and stomach acid up into the esophagus where they don't belong? So there's a microbiome process to all that. And we know from our experience with IsoThrive that we seem to feed a subset of bacteria that are competitive with these gram-negative organisms. And what we believe is happening, let me back up a step. IsoThrive has had very high success in its customers and in my patients with heartburn. A very high percentage seem to have improvement, which is unusual for prebiotic soluble fiber. What we believe is happening is we're feeding a specific subset of bacteria that are out competing through production of various molecular components. They're out competing the gram-negative organisms, returning the lower esophageal sphincter to a gram-positive predominance. And then the lower esophageal sphincter works appropriately, gastric emptying happens appropriately, and their symptoms disappear.
Wow. You know, just for people that might have been slightly confused by that, because it is science heavy.
Yes.
I like to kind of say to people that this is a perfect example of the harmony that our microbiome is, from our mouth to our back door, you know, from our whole entire gut. It's like there's this really delicate balance. And what you're saying is that, you know, the upset in our diets has created this this lack of a particular bacteria that we didn't even realize was actually helping people to not have acid reflux. And because our diets are lacking in this fiber, and our diets are lacking, period, this balance has been upset, and now people are getting more it's more common to see people with acid reflux and GERD and advanced stages of acid reflux. And so adding something like Isothrive has been shown to actually balance that imbalance again, right? To bring harmony to the microbiome again, and actually, I don't know if we can say the word heal or cure, but bring balance to the GERD and the acid reflux. I mean, that's amazing. You know, I posted something the other day about H. pylori, which I like to talk about in my lectures, which is to say that a lot of experts even don't realize that H. pylori is a bacteria that's native to the lining of the stomach. But then because of the upset and the imbalance in our bodies, in our microbiome, that bacteria starts to overgrow and all of a sudden creates this infection in the body. And really, we're thinking, oh, we must have caught H. pylori because we were off drinking some or eating something bad in another country and we got sick. But that's not it at all. It's just our actual imbalance. And so you're saying it in such a beautiful scientific way that this is going on in us, this disharmony in the microbiome.
Yeah, you put it perfectly. And it's an occupational hazard to talk about the science too much, so I apologize for that.
No, don't. I think we've got a lot of nerds here, so I have a lot of nerdy listeners, including myself, and then we have people who just like that I make things digestible.
Yes.
And easy to hear. So no, please don't edit what you say on my account. So where were we? Carry on.
Okay. You mentioned H. pylori just a second ago, and I think that's a particularly useful example. If we go back 50 years, we really didn't know about H. pylori. People got ulcers. We thought their ulcers were, you know, best treated with milk and change in minor changes in diet. Then we discovered medications that decrease acid production and seem to be able to help cure ulcers. And then a scientist found a bacteria that was in the stomach, H. pylori, and he proved that you can cause ulceration by ingesting that bacteria, and then you can cure the ulcer by treating that bacteria with antibiotics. Mm-hmm. So bacteria really do have different roles in different times. And that research has progressed further now, where we're the medical community, we are starting to worry that we're eradicating H. pylori too much. Because it turns out that H. pylori, there's evidence in the scientific literature that H. pylori is against certain diseases like asthma. And if you eradicate it in everybody, then, you know, the early part of life, you won't have it and you may not be protected from those things. And it's maybe not coincidental that the increase in asthma and other allergic type phenomenon coincides with this period where we're getting better and better at identifying H. pylori and trying to eradicate it.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we're learning about the whole body now, right? The function that some of these bacteria have, where we used to think, okay, let's just sterilize everything. Let's just throw antibiotics at all of it and we'll be good. And now we're realizing, oh, this is this kind of like a coral reef or the Amazon rainforest where we need the good guys and the bad guys, and it needs to be very balanced or else things really do go awry. And now getting to a point where, you know, we're having antibiotic resistant bugs happening, and that's a scary thing. Can you speak on that a little bit?
antibiotic-resistant bugs are a direct response to what we're doing. That is, we're trying to kill them, and they're trying to stay alive. And they do that through evolutionary means, just like any other living organism. The thing is, bacteria evolve relatively quickly. So bacteria divide, say, every 20 to 30 minutes when they're metabolically active.
Wow.
Multiple generations of a bacteria happen in, you know, a day or a week. Wow. Unlike humans, where we, our cells are also evolving, but on a much slower time scale. And so as we develop these new treatments, different types of antibiotics or other treatments to kill bacteria, they're constantly waging war with us, trying to evolve new mechanisms to avoid the ability of those things to kill them. And the bad news for us is they do that very quickly because their evolutionary process is so fast.
And they've been around a lot longer than we have, so the chances are they're better at it.
Exactly. In fact, that's one of the things that we're hopeful about the microbiome is that in returning the system to homeostasis, where the bacteria and the human cells are cooperatively helping keep the organism, us, healthy, that infectious disease may be less of a problem because the balance is there. You've got defense mechanisms, bacterial defense mechanisms, and immune function help keep us healthy from infectious disease. Hmm. That's the hope.
So can you speak on a little bit about SIBO? This is coming up more and more, and I feel like, you know, it's partly because of what you mentioned earlier, that the microbiome, and now what the microbiome is changing, and bacteria is changing, and things are starting to try to figure out how to survive. And I mean, when I first started my practice 12 years ago, I didn't even know what SIBO was. Partly that was because I didn't have as rich an education as I do now, but I think it wasn't as popular, as common as it is now. I mean, literally, it is out of five clients that I counsel, three of them mention it. So,
Two things there. First, SIBO is a hard condition to diagnose from a diagnostic standpoint, speaking from a physician standpoint. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons I think that you're seeing more people be understanding that it exists because the diagnostic techniques have improved. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is it probably really is increasing in frequency, and that's a combination of things. We talked about these changes in dietary patterns and the ability of those patterns to change bacteria. And SIBO is small intestinal bowel overgrowth. That's where the acronym comes from. It's bacteria growing in the small intestines where they don't belong. Well, how can that happen? Possibility number one is a lot of people are taking acid suppressant medications, H2 blockers, for intermittent reflux kinds of symptoms. Well, that decreases the acidity in the stomach, and that's the primary barrier keeping the bacterial world outside of us and keeping our innards to ourselves. And decreasing the potential for competition of our good bugs. So all this use of acid blockers may be reducing the barrier to bacteria coming in, and therefore they come in and end up in the small intestines instead.
So just before you go on, because I know I'll forget this, would that also probably play into the reduction of our ability to produce hydrochloric acid? Because I know that that has diminished as well with all of these processed foods and medications and high levels of stress. And so our hydrochloric acid production level has dropped. So even if someone hasn't been taking antacids, they don't have their acid bath to protect them, their natural acid bath that we're meant to have to protect them. So that would play into it as well. Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
The other possibility is the increased use of probiotics. Okay. And I'll admit that's still controversial. Think about it. It might actually make sense. That is, we're trying to introduce bacteria ostensibly into the colon. That's the whole point behind probiotic foods and probiotics, is to get those bacteria in the colon where they'll do some good. Mm-hmm. But they get passed through the small intestine, and they're alive. Is it possible that we're, in some people, perhaps for very specific reasons that are specific to them and not to others, that they seed their small intestine And then they end up with bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine and all the symptoms of SIBO, the gas and bloating, abdominal pain, et cetera.
Wow. That's so interesting.
Yeah. And I can tell you that there is some research that is supportive of that concept. There are some probiotic supplements that are spore-forming bacteria. So they will survive stomach acid. However, in animal models, they germinate in the small intestine. They don't germinate in the colon. Hmm. So it's an example where there's hard science behind the possibility of taking a probiotic supplement and having growth in the small intestine instead of the colon where you really want it.
So is the small intestine totally sterile, or are there any bacteria that live there?
Yeah, there are bacteria everywhere. So no, definitely the small intestine has a bacterial population that's unique to the small intestine and unique to the environment of the small intestine, both the foods that pass through as well as secretions of the cells in the area. Mm-hmm. But it's significantly less bacteria. That is, the colon is where most bacteria are, many magnitudes of order more bacteria in the colon than there are in the small intestine or the stomach or the esophagus or the mouth.
So this would make sense why consuming the cultured veggies would be really wise, because they also have that fiber, and they're kind of pre-digested. So if someone has low stomach acid, that's not an issue, or if they're taking antacids or whatever. So they just make their way into the small intestine, get broken up, and then the bacteria themselves make their way into the colon. And they come with their prebiotic fiber and whatnot. So it's a complete source of this prebiotic fiber and bacteria load that we need. What about people that have, I get a lot of people who eat the fermented veggies and they have some distress from it, but it's normal. It's like a die-off type of thing. But what about people who just can't? Like, they get histamine reactions and they, what do you think of that?
Yeah, for them, I think a supplement is the answer. Mm-hmm. Giving them the a lot of the healthful qualities of fermented foods, that is the fermented fiber that's in them, without all the other components that in those particular patients are causing side effects. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a lot of products out there, and I have some of my favorites that are plant-based fibers. But this fermented fiber is not something that you see. This was new to me, and I love it. Are there any drawbacks to isolate? Because I'm assuming you have to isolate this in a lab the way you would, so you can remove the fermented. Well, why don't you tell us instead of me trying to make it up?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Isothrive is we use a natural fermentation process. So okay. What Louisiana State University discovered is that one of the bacteria that's in typical fermented food can be taken out of the food, put into a fermentation vat, fed the sugars that it normally is taking from the food without the food, put in nutrient bath, those sugars, and allow the fermentation process after 24, 32 hours of fermentation. You then remove all the cells, clean up any color, et cetera, and you end up with a very pure prebiotic soluble fiber. So it's a very natural process. There's not a lot of manipulation. The bacterial world, the natural world, is doing all the hard work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes perfect sense, because it's not like you are trying to. What you're going for is the fiber, and so you're isolating the fiber. It's not like you're removing anything good that you needed. It's like you're isolating exactly what it is that you want to have. Feeding on that prebiotic fiber prebiotic fiber. It's so fascinating about that. Can you say the name of it first? The MIMO, the name of the.
Isothrive, the molecule in Isothrive is a maltosyl isomalto oligosaccharide, which we obviously call MIMO for short, MIMO. As the name implies, maltosyl isomalto oligosaccharide. It's an oligosaccharide. It's a medium chain carbohydrate, that it can't be digested by humans. We don't have the enzymes for it, and therefore makes it into the colon and other parts of the gastrointestinal system to feed helpful bacteria.
So this is actually also really good for people who who probably have celiac and really have a difficult time eating any kind of starches, and or maybe they don't eat any starches at all. And, you know, we've talked about this before, about how these paleo diets and the ketogenic diet, and there's a very healthy way to do these diets, but a lot of people are foregoing that 80% of vegetable matter they should be having with that, and they're thinking high protein, high fat, high protein, high fat, and they're getting like little portions of vegetables, having entire meals with no vegetables at all. This is the perfect fix for that, because it, I mean, is it?
I'd say it's a component of the perfect fix. I would prefer, if I'm talking to a patient about this exact topic, I would prefer that they remove refined carbohydrates completely, decrease carbohydrates in general somewhat, with a corresponding increase in fat and protein, but adding back the fiber either by the high plant content, so you get the plant fibers, or a fermented supplement, plus minus a plant-based supplement, a fructooligosaccharide, if they can't or won't increase the plants.
So, yeah, I mean, that's something like I was thinking about with children that have autism or that are in the spectrum of autism, like ADHD and ADD and different behavioral disorders, where they have real issues with their food, and they maybe they have three or four things on their diet if they're lucky, and none of those include vegetables. So, you know, this would be a really good thing to add to a child's diet. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. Any child post-weaning, so if they're still drinking breast milk, they're getting all the prebiotics, all the fiber that they need. But once they wean, their microbiome needs to continue to be fed in order to develop healthfully. And so either the right foods or supplements, perfectly appropriate from the time of weaning all the way through the rest of life.
Wow. And it's tasty, too, because I like it. I mean, it's I can't imagine any child you know, in the spectrum or not in the spectrum, that wouldn't just like eat that stuff right off their finger. But you did mention breast milk. So what about children that are formula fed? And no, I'm not talking about, you know, homemade formula fed either. I mean, like, you know, I won't mention any products names, but the ones that are start with fructose corn syrup in them.
Yep.
So they could certainly use this. I mean, you could even put this into the formula, maybe?
Absolutely. No reason you can't. And in fact, manufacturers are hard at work to try and return some of this soluble fiber into formula to try and make it much closer to breast milk. I think there are already some manufacturers that have released some products with sort of early prebiotic soluble fiber in them. But yeah, you could, I mean, isolates a liquid, you could easily add that to a bottle of formula and do some of the same things that the companies are trying to do to make their infant formula healthier.
Well, that should be something the FDA should have been doing ages ago, but we won't go down that road. But just basically having, you know, a formula that is as close to breast milk as possible, which means it doesn't have high fructose corn syrup. The children that my husband and I work with that are, you know, that have issues, that have all sorts of digestive issues and spinal cord issues and all sorts, and they're being fed on formula because they can't eat, some of these children, and their teeth are completely rotten from this stuff, and this is all they're getting. I mean, granted, they're not getting all the nutrients they need to be getting, and they have other things going on as well, but just from the formula alone creating this, like, you know, decay in the teeth, it's unbelievable. And it's just nice to come across products like this that are, that could change the life of someone, you know, the quality of life of someone, just in a little tiny packet like this. It's just, it really is an incredible creation, and I commend you on it totally.
Thank you.
Yeah. So back to the breastfeeding, right? So the adding it into formula or giving it to a child, is there a dosing? Or can you take too much? Will it constipate?
The easy answer to that is a little bit sciencey. The colon has a lot of bacteria, but the relative amount of bacteria in a two-year-old baby's colon as opposed to an adult is not that big. The difference between their colon and their esophagus is much larger than the difference between their colon and my colon, in terms of bacterial populations. Mm-hmm. So unlike a pharmaceutical where you really have to adjust the dose quite carefully based on body weight, body fat, et cetera, this is a food molecule. You really don't have to do that. And especially since this is not a food molecule that's feeding the baby or the adult, it's actually feeding the bacteria inside them. And the relative concentrations are not that different. No real reason to the dosage.
Oh, interesting. So I read this book, I think it was called The Superhuman Organism, or it might have been I Contain Multitudes. Both of those books are fantastic.
And absolutely.
One of them talks about how babies can't digest breast milk, that it's actually the bacteria that do it because of what's in the breast milk, and the bacteria break down the breast milk into, finish the sentence for me.
Oligosaccharides.
Yeah, right. There's something about fats, though, that help to seal the lining of the baby's intestine, the lining of the colon, because I guess it's somewhat permeable when they're born, and that this process that the bacteria does to the milk helps to seal the colon, which is just amazing. So if the baby doesn't acquire the microbiome needed at birth, like it doesn't acquire all those bacteria from the mother, maybe it's C-section, or maybe the mother has a lot of gut dysbiosis or something, and then the baby seems like he's allergic to the breast milk. But really what's happening is maybe he doesn't have these particular bacteria that can break down the breast milk. Is that right? Is that possibility?
Partially right and partially wrong. Let me explain that.
Okay.
Breast milk has lots of prebiotic soluble fiber, a particular type called galacto-oligosaccharides. When the baby ingests those, the baby does not break them down. And part of what those bacteria do is nourish the lining of the colon. So they make the cells healthier. They make the tight junctions, the connections between the cells tight. The mucus lining stays nice and thick. And so that barrier function is really good. In babies who aren't getting breast milk, or in adults who were breastfed and then over time, you know, their diet became less and less fiber-oriented, what's happening is those same bacteria are still inside. And they're still trying to survive, but they're not getting the food that they need to do it efficiently. And the bad news is work by Justin Sonnenberg at Stanford and Eric Martens at University of Michigan have shown that those bacteria have what they've called a nutrient hierarchy, meaning they like dietary fiber first. And if dietary fiber is there, that's what they're going to eat. But if dietary fiber isn't there, either because of lack of breast milk in babies or lack of other prebiotic soluble fiber in adults, they will then turn to their second food source. So that thinning or thickening of the mucus lining that you were describing is definitely it's a big part of the advantage of soluble fiber in the diet.
Wow. That's amazing, because this could be the difference between a child, you know, having an infant having a leaky gut from the word go, right? I mean, this is
absolutely
a big deal. And this could explain a lot of these problems that children are having with, you know, so much gut dysbiosis as an infant. You see so much of this. It's unbelievable. And so many allergies. So I guess if that gut remains permeable to some degree, when that child gets adult food like peanut butter or strawberries, and they can't be broken down properly, that gut is somewhat permeable, and those things can make their way into the bloodstream, creating an allergic response, or
both allergic or inflammatory. There's a growing body of evidence that leads experts to believe that exactly what you just described is what's happening. The barrier function of the colon is breaking down. So bacteria and or bacterial metabolites and or other food substances are able to cross the colon in a way they're not supposed to. And the immune system therefore reacts. Initially, that causes localized inflammation, and localized inflammation, as you may know, can lead to things like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, mm-hmm. or maybe they go on long enough that it starts to get into the bloodstream, as you were describing, and precipitates either allergic reactions or other downstream problems from the inflammation that's now systemic.
Wow.
Diseases in general, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, inflammatory arthritis, they all have a background of chronic inflammation. And there's a growing body of evidence that this may be one of the root causes in many people.
Well, I'm convinced, you know, and this is why I, you know, call myself Healthy Gut Girl, is because I really do feel like you can't go wrong by going back to the gut and just starting to address that. And as many tools as we can acquire, as many resources, as many healthy, natural ways to do this as possible is awesome. And that's why I think IsoThrive really caught my eye. I was thinking, wow, this, because I teach people to make fermented vegetables, and I have been doing that for 10 years. And even I go through phases where I haven't had any at all, you know, and I'm eating out and I go to In-N-Out Burger or I have pizza or whatever, and this happens. And so it's just such a handy and powerful thing to be able to know that I'm covered if I have those times, you know.
And we all do in modern society. Like, as we were talking about earlier, our ancestors didn't have any choice. Mm-hmm. They couldn't just walk to the refrigerator or down to Pizza Hut and get food. So fermented foods were always around and they were always consumed. In the modern day life, not the case.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a bleak picture that I paint often, or that we paint often in my shows and in, you know, the work that I do. And I always try to kind of be positive about it all, because it can be very daunting to think, all right, I just had a baby. I had a C-section. I was on antibiotics for 6 months before I got pregnant. I have heavy metal exposure. My baby is allergic to my breast milk already. I don't have time to make fermented veggies. Oh my God. They just want to, you know, throw their arms up in the air and just cry. So,
yep.
And so I'd like to give some positive words, like, besides having something like IsoThrive to save the day, but also, what do you think about, can you recuperate the health of a gut that, like the woman I just described, can you recuperate that person's health? Not you per se, but is it possible for that person to regain, you know, optimum health?
Yeah, it depends on that's a very individualized question. Let me give you a couple of examples. Somebody who has maybe SIBO symptoms or irritable bowel symptoms. So they got some abdominal rumbling, some pain, some intermittent cramping, some gassiness. Can you return that person to optimum health? Possibly. That is, I don't think that person is too far down the pathology trail for it to be realistic to return them sort of to equilibrium. A different patient who is perhaps a lot sicker. So they have bad ulcerative colitis, and they also have rheumatoid arthritis, and they also have heart disease. That is, they have many different areas of their body that have been impacted by these inflammatory processes that probably started in the colon. Can you return them to optimal health? The information's not in yet. That is, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But it definitely is not going to hurt. It most likely will help. Just not sure it can cure in those situations.
Mm-hmm. And since you are a doctor, I always like to ask my medical doctor guests about antibiotics. And you know, antibiotics saved my life and many people's lives, and probably on multiple occasions for me. But, you know, I also have become a practitioner because I was so sick from the being on antibiotics for so long. So yep. Now there's such an issue and people don't know. They go to the doctor, they have a cough and they feel sick and they feel like they have the flu or something. And I think it was a study came out that said that something like 73% of chronic bronchitis cases were being put on an antibiotic. And they were saying how that is a viral infection. And so many people are getting put on antibiotics. But how do you know as a patient? You come in and you how do you hack that? How would you say to the doctor, I'm worried, how do we know that I even need this? Like, how do we start to mitigate the damage and possibly get away from always being given a Z-Pak every time we go to the doctor?
Yep. What you want to do to hack the system, what mm-hmm. you want to do is try and find doctors that are reluctant to give you antibiotics. And they examine you, and the first thing they suggest is antibiotics without talking about possibility that's virus, maybe you don't need them. that may be your first clue that they sort of are predisposed to give antibiotics too freely. Then you can ask the question, is it possible that this is a virus? Need the antibiotics? And it, the next step is, if they say, no, absolutely, you need the antibiotics, again, they may be leaning a little too heavily toward prescribing antibiotics. I would much prefer to see a doctor where he recommends antibiotics to me, looks in my ear and says, yeah, I think you got an ear infection, we're going to give you some antibiotics. And I ask the question, is it possible that it's viral and doesn't need an antibiotic? And he has a conversation with me. Yeah, you know, it's a possibility. The statistics are that 60% chance it's viral, 40% chance. That is, he actually has a conversation with you and gives you what I call educated guidance so you can make a quality decision for yourself as to whether or not that recommendation is appropriate for you. That's the doctor I want to go see.
That's beautifully said. I really, because I didn't even really know. I try to say to people, you know, to ask for culture and sensitivity testing and things like that. But you also don't want to go in and act like you know more than they do, you know. But that is such a beautiful way to present that to a doctor, to find out more, to understand what they're like. That's so good. Same thing with anything, not just respiratory stuff, but also with gut stuff and going in and getting prescribed a antacid, you know, right away, just right out the gate. Oh, it sounds like you've got heartburn. Here you go. Here's some Prilosec. 2 years later, they're still on Prilosec. And, you know, these kinds of things. So asking, is it necessary that because I shouldn't really be on this long term, right? Because antacids are really not meant for that. Is that right?
Yeah, although we talked about it in terms of antibiotics, it's true of all medications. Mm-hmm. You want to have a conversation with your doctor, and you'd really like your doctor to speak with you and listen and then speak again so that you're getting an educational process. If you're not getting that from your doc, you might want to be looking for a new doctor.
Yeah. So what you sound so, you know, there's the new rush of doctors coming into the world, I think, into the field. That are have a really nice balance of the holistic aspect to healing, as well as, you know, the medical aspect to healing. And I'm so happy about this. And I think it's people that stay in the research, like yourself. They stay educating themselves and not just being educated by a pharmaceutical rep that comes in. And what drives you in that way? I'm so curious, because you certainly have a passion for this.
I think the easiest way to characterize it as intellectual curiosity. I'm just by nature a curious person. I want to know. And it's not just in medicine. I want to know how my automobile works, why the mechanic is recommending that I have my oil changed, or that I have the altimeter altered. That is, intellectual curiosity and a wish or a need to continually learn is important for docs, important for everybody. It's one of the things I try and get all my patients to do, is be thinking about things. Don't just take somebody's word for it. Do a little investigation. And the good news is, with the modern internet, you can find a lot of information. It's not hard to educate yourself. You just got to be able to filter the information, especially in medicine, because there's a lot of stuff that's not accurate.
Yeah, that's the truth for sure. That's why I love having people like you on my team, because I can just text you or email you and say, hey, what do you think of this study? Or what, you know, is this accurate? Because, you know, we don't know. I certainly don't know. And there is a lot of information out there. So so tell us more about IsoThrive and how people can get it and all
yeah.
that good stuff.
IsoThrive currently is sold either through our website, isothrive.com, mm-hmm. or on Amazon. So there's sort of two areas. We're not currently in any store shelves, except for a few very select areas in the Bay Area where we're headquartered. So right now it's either through the website, our website, or through Amazon. Unless you're in Hong Kong, because we do have a distributor who believes that Chinese people will understand this really, really well. And it, in particular, it seems to be really good for constipation, which I was unaware of. Apparently in China and Hong Kong, there's a fairly high incidence of constipation, and IsoThrive does really well with those patients. So
wow.
You go to Hong Kong, you walk into a pharmacy, you might see IsoThrive on the shelf.
Wow. So that is slightly counterintuitive to some people that might think fiber. I mean, it definitely fiber moving the bowels, but Ingesting a lot of water, obviously, is really important to hydrate the colon. And then the Isothrive comes in, and it does the work of feeding the bacteria. And then it's like bulking up and getting rid of garbage that's in the bowel and helping the body to eliminate and detoxify and whatnot. That's amazing, because certainly constipation is starting to become a lot more common here as well. I mean, it's definitely, I see it constantly.
Yep.
Wow, that's good to know. And so, and it's something that you can take. I mean, I'm just eating it right out the packet because I don't eat a lot of sweet things, and it's just so nice. It's like a little treat. So I just eat it right out the packet. But you can put it in, because if you can't destroy it, and you can't cook it out, right? Like you can't cook some fibers.
Yeah, so, we have a few food manufacturers that are experimenting with putting it into their foods and then, you know, cooking the foods appropriately. So, you can add it to food, you can add it to drink, preferably warm drink or hot drink, things like coffee or tea, because it dissolves better in the heated liquids. Mm-hmm. Or you take it right out of the package, which, like you said, you do, and that's the way I usually do it as well. Mm-hmm. And just so your audience knows, although it is slightly sweet, no sugar. The molecule is naturally sweet. So it, the molecule that you don't digest does stimulate the taste buds a little bit and gives you that sweet quality that we call a nectar, but no added sugar.
So now that you say that, we just have to do a little disclaimer, because people, a lot of my, you know, my listeners, we go through, like I have my program, the Total Gut Makeover, and it really eliminates almost all kinds of sugar. For maybe you can have some banana. So so if you get some Isothrive, you can't overdose on it, but you also don't want to eat like 3 or 4 or 5 packets a day, right? I didn't do it. I swear I never did that.
Yeah, no. Big doses, in the studies that we've done, we haven't noticed a difference in terms of microbiome effect, bigger dose, smaller dose, you know, somewhere between 0.5 gram to 1.5 grams. So
okay.
We're in the sweet spot from an evolutionary standpoint.
Okay. So no matter how much you like it, it's really more about, you don't really want to waste it and have a, you know, like take a whole bunch of it. Since people who like sweet stuff, they're going to really like this stuff. I mean, it's really tasty.
Yeah. I'd say if you have a really fat wallet and you want to spend a lot of money, then yeah, you can take more, but that's unnecessary. It's
okay.
Kind of a waste.
Yeah. So is there anything else that we might have skipped over, missed, or anything you can think of that you want to share with my listeners?
I'll mention some unpublished research, but I'm not going to speak about it at length.
Okay.
Only in that it hasn't been published yet, but we just finished a series of experiments with an anti-cancer researcher. And what we found is that when Isothrive is fed to bacteria that populate the colon, that live on the colon wall, they produce substances that seem to inhibit or kill colon cancer cells.
Wow.
At least in the lab, definitely true. Now, obviously, we'll need to do clinical trials, et cetera, so it'll be a lengthy process before that actually comes out, potentially as a either preventive for colon cancer proven or maybe even a colon cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But the possibility is raised by the fact that we know in the lab, you take colon cancer cells, feed bacteria, Isothrive, they produce substances, those colon cancer cells die.
That's incredible. I can't wait to see more of that. And I'm sure that has, you know, like we were talking about with ulcerative colitis and all of these other things that, you know, if left alone, they can advance into cancer and, you know, really cause great harm and can be terminal for some people. So this is incredible stuff. And so I want to also say, for people who are taking probiotics, like a capsule or a supplement, it's not like we're discouraging that. That's fine, but just feeding the existing microbiome that you have is really where this research is starting to go. I mean, we do want a diverse microbiome, but it's possible, maybe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but by feeding the one we have, it can actually become even more diverse. Is that right?
In fact, we've seen that research that we've done where people who respond to Isothrive, the diversity of bacteria in the colon increases, and it seems to increase in the direction of hunter-gatherers' microbiome and away from modern society's microbiome. So wow. Positive changes from an evolutionary standpoint.
I mean, that's fantastic news. And that's also, it's shocking, you know, because right now people are just starting to hear about probiotics. People are just starting to hear more about probiotics in terms of it not just being a yogurt, but actually hearing about lactobacillus and bifidus and, you know, these different beneficial yeasts. And they're starting to hear about the bugs in the body just in time for things to change again, for us to say, listen, actually just feed the ones you have, which actually makes things a lot simpler too, if you think about it. It sure saves you a lot of money, because high quality probiotics, boy, talk about needing a fat wallet.
In fact, you mentioned a couple comments about that. When I'm counseling my patients, I always say, no reason that you have to take them. If you're taking a soluble fiber like Isothrive, you're feeding your natural ones. If you really want to take them, if you're a big believer that probiotics work, no problem. Go ahead and take them, but make sure you're taking soluble fiber at the same time.
Right. Wow, that's... well, I love it. I love the solution, and I love the idea. I love where it's all going. So I'm super excited that you came today and that you're here with us, because I think this is this big wave of information that's happening in society right now, and you are at the front of it, and that's exciting. It's very, very exciting.
It's kind of a culmination of my career. I went into medicine because I want to help people. And initially, you do that one at a time. You see people in the exam room, and you hope to make a difference for them individually.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, 20 or 30 patients a day that I can do that with. My next step in my career was, so I had a group of physicians who each were seeing those numbers of patients, and I was helping to educate them and making sure they're up to speed and having good quality conversations with their patients. So a larger subset of patients than I could ever touch personally. Mm-hmm. And this is taking that sort of concept on steroids, being able to potentially reach and help millions of people, which for a physician doesn't get better than that.
Yeah. Well, I love the product. I've been on it for a little, what is it, probably about 2 weeks now. And I know that it says that the research shows that it takes about a month or so, right, before you start seeing some changes. I felt like I noticed it really quickly. You know, I'm like a canary in the coal mine type of you know, body type. And I certainly felt a change in bowel movement right away. Like, I just felt like things were bulked up and things were easier to pass. And that was something within the first couple of days that I felt. And so I got super excited. Now it's been 2 weeks and I'm going more regularly. I was pretty regular anyway, but, you know, I always feel like 3 a day is my goal. 3 bowel movements a day. But that's a difficult thing to do unless I'm eating just loads of vegetable matter. And that doesn't always happen. So 2 I'm really happy with. And I feel like the Isothrive is ensuring that, which is great. So I'm happy.
Yeah, the 2 week or month mark, I always counsel my patients not to be impatient. Mm-hmm. It's not a pharmaceutical where it's absorbed and 20 minutes later it's starting to work. It's a food, and it's trying to increase bacterial partner populations. However, there are some people who seem to respond very quickly, and more power to them. That's great. I just want to make sure that my patients don't say, geez, it's been 4 days and I'm still kind of bunched up. Yeah, I'm kind of done. Yeah. And the 2 to 4 weeks comes from the science of prebiotic research. Okay. The research has shown that it takes about 2 weeks to start to change the bacterial populations in a meaningful way. Hmm. So you may notice stuff before that, but if you haven't by that point, it may just be that the bacterial populations haven't changed yet. Yeah. You go out another couple of weeks, all of a sudden things start to kick in.
Exciting. Very exciting stuff. Thank you so much for your time here with us. And for working with me, and I'm really enjoying everything I'm learning from Isothrive and from the team at Isothrive. I really appreciate it. Anything else you got for us?
Really, just a thank you to you for what you do. You're helping people by helping spread educational messages about diet and exercise and healthy lifestyle, and that's wonderful. We need more of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. All right. It's been my pleasure. So I will speak with you soon. And thanks for being here, Dr. Swan.
Thank you. And when we publish our anti-cancer research, I'll send you a copy.
Oh, I'll have you back on after that. Are you kidding?
Beautiful.
Thank you. I told you he was so good. Isn't that amazing? Mimo, finding Mimo. Not Nemo, but Mimo. Maltomalsian oligosaccharides. I know I said that wrong. I butchered it. But super important, and I'm really loving this product right now because I'm so busy. I don't have any time at the moment to be, you know, making cultured veggies and eating 2 to 3 cups a day. So it's nice to have this as a backup. You know, it's great. And I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it already, and I'm digging it. So check out my blog on healthyguckgirl.com and check out that particular one all about the prebiotic. Called What is a Prebiotic? And thanks for listening. Please leave us a review, a friendly review. It really helps us. And follow me on HealthyGutGirl_ on Instagram. On Facebook, I'm Healthy Gut Girl. And on Twitter, I'm at Healthy Gut Girl. And thank you so much to my producer, Ileana Carter, for fixing the little boo-boos with my Wi-Fi that she could. Thank you so much, everyone. And see you soon. Thank you.